Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. So it's another weekly scheduled episode. We're going to talk about one game today for this week. And we're going to talk about how it's played, and we're going to talk about how it was designed. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about on this regularly weekly scheduled episode that we have here today?
We are talking about Hive, designed by John Yiani and published by Gen 42 in 2001. And among the various awards it's been nominated for, it won a Mensa Select in 2006.
Interesting. All right, so to give a short description of Hive, in Hive, two players attempt to surround the other player's queen bee by taking turns playing or moving their hexagonal bug tiles. Other than a queen, each player has three ants, three grasshoppers, two spiders, and two beetles, and each piece moves differently in relation to the other pieces on the board. The game starts with an empty board. Players must play their queen within their first three turns, and players cannot move their bug pieces until their queen has been played. After that, play just continues with each player taking alternating turns until either one or both queens have been surrounded. Or, I guess, nobody can make any moves, which I don't think that's a possibility in this game.
Yeah.
So that's the gist of Hive. Although we're going to spend a bit of time here getting into the strategy portion, just describing the rules in a bit more detail.
Let's go ahead and talk about how the bugs move.
Well, before we do that, I want to talk about how the board works.
Oh, right, sure.
So this is a game kind of like chess, where you're trying to surround the opponent's piece instead of checkmate it, but surrounding it's kind of like checkmating it in this game. There's no board, though. The board, in quotes, is made up by the pieces, which are always connected to each other. You're placing these hexagonal tiles connected to each other, and when they move, they stay connected to each other. And you cannot break connection into multiple groups. They have to remain one continuous body throughout the game. When you're playing this game, you can choose to either add new pieces to the board on your turn or move the pieces that you already have on the board. To add a new piece, you just pick one of your pieces that isn't on the board yet, and you attach it to one of your pieces that's already on the board, but in a place where it would not touch one of your opponent's pieces, and it could also slide into place wherever you're placing it. And this concept of sliding into place is important for the movement of a couple other pieces. And that's just to say that these are hexagonal pieces. And so if the space is wide enough for the hexagonal piece to slide into it, then you can place a piece there. If the gap is too narrow to slide the hexagonal piece through, then you can't put a piece inside that gap.
Right. You literally mean pushing it along the surface that you're playing this game on.
Yeah, pressing it flat against the table.
Physically sliding it in, yeah.
Exactly. Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk about how the pieces move once they're placed on the board.
Right. So I guess let's start with the ant, because the ant's pretty simple.
Sure.
So the ant can move to any space on the board that it can slide into.
Right. It's the most mobile unit in the game. All the other units have more limited movement. The ant can literally go anywhere as long as it could slide into that location. So right. It can't go into holes in the middle of the board, but anywhere on the outside of the board it can go.
Right. And similarly to the ant is the spider, which can move three spaces in either direction. So like
around the perimeter.
Yeah. So it goes around the next three edges of pieces that it can touch. And this again can only go into where it can slide into.
Right. The next piece is the grasshopper. This piece will jump in a straight line over every piece until it gets to a gap. So that means that it could jump to the other side of the board if the line, if the row of pieces that you're jumping over stretches from one end to the other. It could also mean that it can jump into a gap in the center of the board that, say, an ant or a spider could not reach because it's closed off. A grasshopper could get in there by leaping over the pieces in a straight line. And when I say in a straight line, these are all hexagonal pieces. So you're sort of picking a flat edge that the grasshopper is connected to, and you're following that in a straight line across all the other flat edges until you get to the end.
Right.
If that makes sense. And then you can't just choose any angle, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. And then the last piece is the beetle. The beetle can only move one space. Well, I guess second to last piece. The beetle can only move one space at a time. And if you're moving along edges, it can only move into where it can slide into. Mm-hmm. However, it can move on top of other pieces. And each move on top of a piece is one space again, similarly. And if the beetle is on top of an opponent's piece, then the opponent's piece can't move. And for the purposes of placing more insects, the area that the beetle is on counts as your insect.
Right.
Yeah.
The beetle can also hop down from pieces. So that's right. The other piece that can hop into holes in the center of the board that, say, an ant or a spider couldn't reach. They can hop on top of a piece and then walk over to that hole and then hop down into it.
Right. And then the what's important to note is that the queen bee can also move. It can just move one space at a time in any direction along the perimeter to where it can slide into or out of.
Right. So the queen is kind of like a king in chess in that it has limited mobility, probably the most limited mobility of any piece in the game.
Yeah.
And the slowest movement of any piece in the game.
Exactly. It should be noted that you cannot move a piece so that it separates another piece from the rest of the board.
Right. Everything has to stay one continuous group. Even if you could move a piece so that where it ended up, it would reconnect the board, you can't do that.
Yeah.
It has to stay connected. And that gets into my first piece of strategy, yes, which is a concept in this game. Okay, so there's a concept in this game that stems from this rule that you can't break the pieces apart on the board. And that concept is, I called it pinning, which might be a little confusing for somebody who plays chess because pinning has a different meaning there.
It's similar.
But it's a similar meaning. The idea is that, I'll just use an example. If somebody places an ant on the board, an ant is a very powerful piece because it can move very quickly anywhere you want it to go. So someone attaches an ant to the board. You can take your ant or whatever piece can move into position there and place it on the end of that ant so that the ant that your opponent played on their turn is the only thing connecting your piece to the rest of the pieces on the board. And that essentially just prevents your opponent from ever moving that piece until they create an alternate connection, which takes effort.
Yeah, it's harder to do that as well because the opponent can't play any pieces between your piece and theirs.
Yeah, they would have to play another piece and then move it. Exactly. Or they would have to move a piece that they already have, in which case you bought yourself a free turn.
Right, yeah.
So pinning is an important strategy in this game. And in the early stages of the game, it's more important to be pinning your opponent's strong pieces instead of worrying about surrounding their queen.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about... Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say... Oh, I have a bit other thing, though, is that early game, I think it's really important to just get pieces out.
Sure.
Because, if you want to surround your opponent's queen, you're going to need probably around four or so pieces on average.
Mm-hmm.
Because the opponent's pieces can count towards that surrounding. And so though you want to be able to get pieces out quicker than the opponent because it gives you more options both defensively and offensively.
I will say that depending on the pieces, you might want to prioritize pinning them instead of putting out new pieces. for example, if they play an ant, you might want to pin that with your ant or whatever piece that you've already played. Just because if you can think of it like this, you both have a piece out, but your piece is canceling out their piece, but your piece is not being canceled out itself. So you have one piece on the board, they have no pieces on the board by pinning their ant, and that'll be true until they're able to free up their ant.
Well, here's how I would put it, though. So say first three things, you know, it's like something, queen, and then ant. And then you were to move your ant to pin down my ant, I just play another ant. Then you basically wasted a turn instead of adding a piece, and I was able to add a piece myself, meaning I have more things on the board, more options, the thing. More control.
But here's the thing. Now we both have ants.
Right.
We both have one ant each, essentially. Even though you have another ant, that ant is pinned, so it's a non-piece. And now it's my turn, so I can play another piece. Now I have two pieces and you have one.
Right, and then, this is what I mean, though, is that then I just play another piece and I'm up a piece.
You're not. We're even, is what I'm saying. Because my ant is negating your first ant. So, sure. I mean, it's not technically negating it entirely, because if I were to have to use my ant, then your ant would be free. So it's only temporarily negated.
Yeah, that's what I mean, is that in the long run, having the more pieces is more important.
And sure.
Like,
even think of it also this way, because it's an ant and you only have so many ants, at the end of this whole sequence, you might only have two ants and I might have all three because I pinned one of your ants.
Sure. But I'll still have more pieces, which means it's easier for me to surround your queen.
I mean, that's true, but I think the tempo is even at this point in the game.
I don't know.
We have the same number of active pieces because I'm pinning your ant.
Right.
And when I move my ant to unpin your ant, it's because I'm doing something that's more important than keeping your ant pinned.
Right. But in that time, I have more threats on the board.
No, so, you don't. I just explained how we have the same number of pieces.
But in the end, if you have to move your ant, then it doesn't matter.
Well, okay, then I'll move my piece when it doesn't matter that you have one extra piece, you know? Like, it's okay to pin an ant at the beginning of the game because you're taking it out, you're resetting the tempo, you're still ahead. Or not necessarily ahead, but you're still even in pieces.
Right, I'm not talking about, like, active pieces. I'm just talking about pieces on the board.
So this is if I went first in the scenario. If sure. You put an ant and then I pin it and then you play another ant and then I play another ant.
Yeah.
This is assuming I went. Okay.
So it's like passing Sentai and Go.
So the trade-off is that I have one of your ants pinned and you do not have any of my ants pinned.
Right. But I have more ants on the board.
Yeah, but one of them's pinned, so we have the same number of ants functionally on the board.
Right.
In fact, after we place more pieces, I'll probably have more because I have three ants and you have two. And one of your ants – you'll have three ants on the board, but one of your ants will be pinned. So you have functionally two ants on the board and I'll have three.
But saying that one of my ants is pinned means that one of your ants is pinning it.
Right, but so I can still choose to move my ant. My ant is still active.
Right, but – never mind. Let's just move on.
I'm just saying it's very small. It's incremental. But in this game, you know, you have very few pieces. So getting the smallest advantages out of every piece is important. And I'm saying that this is a small advantage. Having access to more ants than your opponent, having the same number of pieces as your opponent, but having one of their strongest pieces put out of commission.
And I'm saying that in order to put my ant out of commission, it puts your ant out of commission in the early game.
Sure, but it's not technically out of commission. I can still choose to move it and do something more valuable with it. I can get more value out of my ant.
But the moment you bring it in commission again, mine is in commission again.
Yeah, but I would obviously do that when it's more beneficial for me to move my ant and allow you to move your ant finally.
Sure.
Like clearly, when he gives me the advantage.
Clearly this is a subject we need to just test more.
But I'm thinking if I have the button in my hand that lets me move that ant. So I can do that whenever I want. Look, this game, what we're getting to is this game is very, how about this? Let's reset.
Sure. Yeah.
Let's just say
that's what I'm trying to do.
Let's talk about the beginning of the game.
Okay.
The first few turns.
Okay. Because the opener is important.
So, so we said that you start with zero pieces on the board and then you add, you start to add pieces. In the first three turns, you have to put your queen on the board attached to the other pieces. You just learned that there was an errata to the rules. It used to be you could place your queen first if you wanted to. But there was an errata that said that you can't place your queen first. You have to place something else. And then within the next two turns, you have to place your queen.
Right. This is apparently added due to it being too common to get draws in tournaments if one player played their queen first.
Gotcha. So what do you think is the best piece to play first?
So I think beetle, because
interesting.
The beetle is the slowest to move. Normally if you play it just next to one of your pieces like normal, it takes two turns for it to ever touch an opponent's piece, because you have to put it, you know, move it from next to your piece where it can't be next to an opponent's piece to anywhere else, and then next to an opponent's piece. I mean, I guess unless the opponent's adjacent to you, but it's hard to get it into action that quickly. If you have it in the center, it means that you're right next to an opponent's piece, so when you actually need to get it into your opponent's stuff, it'll be quicker to do that. And now, I want to bring up that when we talk about openers, the positioning of your pieces also matters. I think in this case, the beetle wants you to play your first three pieces so that they kind of wrap around the opponent's pieces. Not like directly, but like, you know, like in a curve.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if I agree with most of that.
Okay.
It seems both of us have very different ideas on how this game is played. Personally, I mean, I think the beetle is an okay piece to start with. I guess, are you getting that you want your pieces to eventually connect, make a second connection with your opponent's pieces so that your beetle could eventually move?
Right.
Okay, yeah, I agree with that, because the beetle is a very useful piece. It may be one of the slower pieces in the game, but it's very useful because you can put it on top of your opponent's pieces, especially their queen, to prevent them from moving anywhere, which is very, very useful. You can use it to fill in holes in the center of the board, which is more difficult to do with a grasshopper and impossible to do with any other piece. And you can also use it to create a hole. So if your beetle is next to your queen and your queen's about to be surrounded, you can pop the beetle out of there to make a hole to keep yourself alive. Right. So I like the beetle as a starter if you're planning on using it. If you're not, if the starter is just kind of a throwaway and you want to play more of a game on the outside of the board with highly mobile pieces, I'd say use a spider as your first piece, because I think the spider is the weakest piece in the game.
Right. It's the second most restrictive next to the queen, maybe even more restrictive, because
it's just as restrictive.
Yeah, sure. Because even though you can move three spaces, it's very limited into, like, you have to move only three spaces. You basically only ever have two options on where to move it.
Right.
And if that's useful is another question.
Yeah, it's just functionally worse than the ant.
Yeah.
It's just strictly worse because it has the same freedom of movement rules as the ant, where it has to be able to slide into place, but it can only move three spaces, precisely three spaces to either direction or clockwise or counterclockwise around the edge of the board. The ant can go anywhere. It's just better than a spider.
Yeah.
I like to start with the spider most games, just because I don't want to spend any extra turns trying to free up that centerpiece. I'd rather spend most of my time focusing on positioning myself to get tempo over my opponent.
Yeah, you can tell from our discussion earlier, Jeffrey's a very tempo-oriented player in this game, so it fits mm-hmm. that much better.
I'm also a value player, I'd say, in this game. Because if you ever see a chance to pin two pieces, you should always take it in this game.
Right, yeah.
And that would just mean, like, if two pieces are set in, like, a straight line out, going outwards from the board, you could place one piece at the end of that line, and then that would pin those two pieces. Neither of them could move without detaching right. the other pieces.
We should also probably just there say, don't put your pieces two in a straight line.
Exactly. Yeah, especially for the opening. Yeah, it might be just kind of tempting aesthetically just to line your pieces up in a straight line for the first few turns of the game. But if you put yours in a straight line and your opponent plays an ant or a cricket, not a cricket, grasshopper, then they can pin your pieces, and then you're set back a number of turns because of that.
I was going to say, going back to openers, if you're playing second and your opponent plays an early ant, I think it might be worthwhile to go, like, spider, queen, grasshopper. Mm-hmm. Because that means that you don't have an ant the opponent can pin.
Well, here's the interesting thing, though. If you don't put an ant down, then your opponent can play anything they want, anywhere they want, without any fear of being pinned themselves.
Right, and then when your ant... and then whenever you do play an ant, they can just go around to that at that point. So, sure.
I think after you play your queen, like, so you play a beetle or a spider first, you play your queen. I think the third piece should almost always be an ant. It's just too powerful a piece not to have on the board as fast as you can.
Yeah, it seems like ants you want to get out as soon as possible. And yeah, they're the most effective in this game.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the knights maybe in chess.
I think you should. So I think that pinning the other player, like you said, it does give up a little bit of tempo because technically you have fewer pieces on the board. But I would argue that you have more options. You have more free up pieces than your opponent does. So pinning first is, I say pin first and then maneuver later.
Sure.
Yeah, if your opponent doesn't have an easy way to pin, develop your pieces, start placing a lot of pieces on the board so that you can start to use them.
Oh, if your queen starts to get surrounded, it might be worthwhile to try to move it out as soon as possible. Because mm-hmm. if you think about, like, your queen has, what would that be, like, three pieces around it? No, four? Mm-hmm. Yeah, if your queen has four pieces around it, it can still slide out in either direction around those.
As long as the two free spaces that it has are next right. to each other.
Right. And if you do that, then it only has one piece surrounding it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of times where moving your queen just one space can be huge value.
Sure.
And it's especially useful if your opponent's putting a lot of resources into surrounding your queen, because then you move it out and they have to recommit all those while you can position your stuff better.
Right. Making sure your queen has an escape route is a very important part of the setup of this game, the setup being like the early stages of the game.
Right.
And also closing off your opponent's queen's escape route.
Right. That's another reason why I would start with Beetle, is because late game, when your queen that you play second or third is starting to get surrounded, you have a Beetle that can just hop on out.
Mm-hmm.
Either way.
Yeah, it's not bad to have that extra hole in the center.
Yeah.
Made by your Beetle. The last piece of strategic advice I have is just to always be aware of the clock, which is to say the number of turns you have before you are surrounded.
Yeah.
And that number of turns, I mean, you can easily look at the number of sides that your queen has open, and that's your basis for your clock. But then you just have to see, like, which pieces of your opponents are going to fill those spots. You know, maybe ants, maybe something else. And if it's something else, do they have to play it down? So you just kind of start adding up turns, the number of opponent's turns your opponent has to defeat your queen. And if that number is higher than the number it would take you to capture their queen, then you can start to make an attack on their queen.
Yeah.
If it's fewer, if your opponent will take you out faster, even if you take this turn now, then you should prioritize getting your queen in a safer spot.
Yeah.
So removing pieces from around your queen, making secondary connections so that your queen isn't pinned, and then finding an escape route.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have just a general checklist, because a lot of this game is planning ahead, much like chess, and getting positional advantages, but mostly about planning ahead and anticipating future moves. So I have just kind of like a rule of thumb kind of checklist for a player that wouldn't want to plan ahead, that just kind of wants to play the game and go by a couple rules of thumb.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So those would be to play all your ants first after the opening that we described, which is either spider or beetle, then queen, then an ant. You should try to get all of your ants out first. Once you have all three ants out, make sure that your queen has an escape route. If ever your opponent pins your queen or something, try and get her out. If you can't, then just move forward in this checklist. Make sure that you are pinning more pieces than your opponent is pinning. Then cut their queen's movement, and then make sure your opponent has fewer open spaces on their queen than you do at the end of your turn.
Yep.
So that would be the gist if you just wanted to kind of play fast and loose.
Okay.
All right. So shall we talk about the design?
Yeah. Seems good.
Okay. So where should we start? I think the first thing I want to start by saying is that the components of this game are really good.
Yeah.
They're made of, I don't know, they're like ceramic or resin tiles. Yeah. They're really big and chunky and smooth. Mm-hmm. So yeah, components are great in this game. It feels good to play this game.
They have enough weight that, like, when you try to slide things into place, it doesn't move everything around.
Right. They have some heft to them.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk more about the actual components or the mechanics and gameplay.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, so Hive is an abstract strategy game, possibly the oldest genre of board games in history. And the sort of key features of an abstract strategy game are that the theme is widely removed, in that, like, there's very little flavor theme or flavor mechanics tie-in, in that the mechanics can pretty much be understood without ever understanding the theme. And also that there's very little diversity in individual effects. So, like, if you think of a card game, every card has very slightly different things and all these knobs and levers. Mm-hmm. An abstract strategy game, every piece only has like two levers.
Right.
And in this case, there's, you know, every piece can either fill in gaps or can only move around the outside. And there is, you know, one that's kind of slower and one that's faster in terms of space gain for each of those categories.
Right.
So it's very, like, concise, very short, and, you know, these are, like, very basic things that are pretty easy to understand.
I think, though, the theme doesn't matter all that much with how to play the game. It is very flavorful with which pieces do what. Like, I mean, the grasshopper hops over all the pieces.
The beetle pins things down with its pincers.
Yeah. The spider and the ant are a little strange. I feel like flavorfully they should be opposite each other.
I was going to say, I think the concept that the ants are really good to get out all of them, or more so than every other thing, makes sense. Because you usually see an army of ants.
But is the spider faster than an ant?
Meh. Spiders tend to stay in one place.
Yeah, but when they strike, they're pretty quick. Like, ants just kind of dirtle along the ground slowly and steadily.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like if there were this like strike raptor, you know, type character that leaves and comes out of nowhere and goes all around the board. That sounds like a spider that's like repelling into place or something. Although that repelling visual doesn't necessarily work with the fact that they can't fill in holes, but
or like a wolf spider maybe.
I think it's a little odd, but I see how you have more pieces of the ant. It kind of makes more sense to have more ants than spiders because there's more ants than spiders in the world, I guess.
Or like I said, you see more ants at any given time. It's mm-hmm. always a swarm of ants.
For the most part, the flavor is pretty on point with what the piece does, which is cool.
Right.
This brings up a thing. Another point that I wanted to make, and that this game has a reversed power balance. So the most common pieces are the most powerful pieces.
Yeah.
As opposed to chess, where the most common pieces are the weakest pieces.
Yeah.
There's a lot of comparisons that you can draw between this and chess, but I think that's similar in other games. Usually the most powerful things, there's only a few of them. So you have to,
you have to protect them.
Yeah, in this game, there's not the most common piece is the most powerful piece.
Yeah, I think in this game it makes sense because of the whole like it's easy to pin down your opponent's pieces. You wouldn't want it to be like you're too afraid to play your powerful piece because it'll just get locked in place.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this game does also have extremely few components. So I can see why you would want most of those components to be active and doing something. So you give them the most powerful movement options so that they can actually move in most situations and do something in most situations. I mean, yeah, at certain points, this game becomes so big and nebulous. The board gets in such a state that like the ants are the only ones that can actually do anything. So I'm happy that I have three of them to work with.
It's also that by giving you more of the pieces that can move further, it kind of makes it look like it's faster paced.
Yeah.
Like you're not doing as tiny movements as often. You have like these more macro movements.
Right. I mean, chess games at a professional level can take hours upon hours to finish, you know, timed games. And if the games weren't timed, then they would take an eternity because people would just think about their move for as long as they could.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that this game would have faster would want a faster pace because it's kind of like a more casual game than chess is. So to achieve that, I could see why they would have more powerful pieces.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, due to the movement pieces, or not the movement rules, but the attachment rules, specifically how you add pieces to the board, it makes sense that you'd have a lot of these mobile pieces because you could move them into a position and then add pieces to the board on the other player's side of the board, if you could even call it their side of the board.
Yeah.
Because there's no rule that says, like, when you put your pieces at the start of the game that they have to be facing you, you know?
Yeah. And with that regard, I do want to bring up another topic. Being Hive is like a modern abstract game that is almost specifically inverse or like specifically different from the older ones. You know, so we've been talking a lot about how it relates to chess, but even just stuff like saying it's like chess but without a board, instead the pieces are a board. Like that's like a selling point, like an elevator pitch that immediately tells you the difference between the game and the older abstract strategy game type of family stuff. But at the same time, it kind of just says, like, this is throwing away all that old crotchety stuff. Like, this isn't your grandpa's abstract strategy game.
Yeah, this is a punk rock abstract game.
I think it definitely takes a step back and kind of looks at, like, what is preconceived notions about abstract strategy games. Because, like, you know, not having a board also helps the modern age of, like, how gaming is played. Because, you know, you think, like, chess, you know, like, nobles would play it in a castle or whatever. And it was okay to have these, like, stationary boards, but with Hive, it fits better with the current day of, like, people going all over the place and playing board games with all these different people, you know, mm-hmm. going to shops, going to conventions, whatnot.
Or even it isn't even packaged in a box. It's packaged in a zip up bag.
Yeah. Or even just traveling in general. It's much more friendly to a more interconnected world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's definitely like I said, it's like the modern abstract strategy game.
Sure.
For a different environment.
I'll say that despite being very different from chess, it does have a lot of parallels that you can draw between itself and chess, which just kind of help to introduce you to the game.
Right.
The existence of the queen, which is essentially the king.
Mm-hmm.
And we call it a queen. It's a bee. It's not even technically a queen bee, I don't think.
I thought it was specifically a queen bee.
I don't know. That might be something in the rule book, but that's not super important. It's a bee, but it's functionally a king. It moves a lot like a king does in chess, and you know, one space at a time, in any direction except over other pieces. And the goal is to surround it.
Yeah.
Essentially, you're not usually surrounding a king per se in chess. You're cutting off its avenues, but it's a similar concept. And you can kind of draw similar comparisons between hive pieces and chess pieces, like the ants are much like the queen in that they have the best movement in the game. The grasshoppers are like
bishops.
I guess they're like bishops. I could also consider them like knights, although I see how spiders could also be kind of like knights. Grasshoppers have the freedom of movement of a bishop in that they can jump over pieces.
Yeah. And that they're better at squeezing into holes.
Right.
Than like
a bishop also is good at like passing through front lines and stuff like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
Right. And then I guess the beetle is a pawn in this game, except it's a very good pawn because it can jump on top of other pawns and,
oh, you mean like pawns?
Yeah, pawns can ride other pawns.
No, I mean, you can capture them with pawns, or you can just sit in front of them and stare at them. But no, yeah, I think the name plus effect, like, convention works very well for this game, the same way it does with chess.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, by saying the name of a piece, you immediately know what it does and what it can do and all that. And it's very easy to remember all the different pieces' effects because of that. I want to say something about the graphic design, by the way.
Okay.
So, I mean, obviously this game, every piece or every insect has a different appearance and a different color as well. And the bee is like a golden yellow, which I think is kind of funny because like it makes you focus on it much more than everything else. Everything mm-hmm. else is a more cool color. There's the ant's blue, the beetle's purple, spider's brown, the grasshopper's green. So having the queen, you know, the goal of the game to surround, be the brightest, warmest color is really fitting. It draws your attention to it.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is the lightest color.
Yeah.
In the bunch. I like how this game doesn't have any removal of pieces.
Yeah. You can't just run out of pieces. I mean, you can, but you can't.
Right. You don't take pieces off the board. And because of that, the game constantly becomes more complex instead of more simple, which is nice. It starts in a good place where you can kind of ramp up into the gameplay and experience it in small pieces that grow upon themselves. You know? So somebody playing this game for the first time wouldn't be overwhelmed. In a chess game.
Exactly.
There's a couple other abstract games that do this. I'm reminded of Othello, I think, with this game, which is another game where the pieces don't get removed, they stay on the board and they constantly become more crazy.
Yeah. That's fair.
And I guess that's also a game where you're adding to a mass in the center of the board. In Othello, you can't play a piece that's not connected to other pieces.
True, yeah.
Yeah. Let's see.
Overall, I just like the whole kind of joke of like, oh, it's hex tiles and it's like a beehive.
Yeah. It's very clever.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was just how the theme came into play. Just like noticing your component and mechanic was like this, and it's like, oh, that works.
So an unfortunate result of how the game starts is that there are very, very bad starts that if an experienced player used them against an experienced player, the experienced player would just dominate the experienced player.
Yeah.
That kind of start being like putting your pieces in a straight line and then the opponent getting to pin all three of your pieces at the start of the game and then develop all of their ants, pin off any piece that you add to the game or not pin them if there's no like threat of them pinning you. So like if they put out three pieces, you pin it with an ant, and then they put out like a grasshopper or a spider or a beetle, anything except an ant, then you can just play all your ants. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That tempo lead is just too huge for the experienced player. The inexperienced player would probably just never be able to win a game like that. Which, I mean, that's probably just a part of these kinds of games, but usually the experienced player has to be very experienced to get into a situation like that.
Yeah, I think
to be able to dominate a situation like that.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, having a lower skill curve like that to get to where you can do really crazy openers, I think is a good thing. Because if somebody's like invested enough in the game to learn like a really good opener, then you would hope that they're not playing against somebody who is completely new and never wants to play the game again. Like, you would at least hope that they know each other. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. Like, I don't, it's hard for me to say, because like in chess, you have to be really invested to get to these good openers, but that means there's a wider skill gap between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But by having a lower skill gap, it's easier to learn them. And by having the opener be just like three moves and then maybe a fourth or fifth move, it's pretty easy to learn like some good sequences.
Yeah, there's not so many options at the beginning of the game.
Right, not much room to mess up either.
Variety of openers. I guess I will say also that the game is fast, so if that does happen, then the game will end quickly, and then you can just try again.
Yeah.
But I will also say, and this will get me into my last point, or my last topic that I want to get to in the design portion, and that's just on abstract games in general. And because an abstract game has no flavor or aesthetic to it, it's entirely just components and mechanics. So when that's all that you have to look at, then you just examine that, and you get to the strategizing in advanced part of this game way quicker, I think, than or in any abstract game than you would in another game, where like if there's some kind of flavor for you to or some kind of narrative for you to play out, you know. Right, in another game you might be more inclined to follow that narrative. In this game there is no narrative, so you just have to kind of play the game.
Yeah, it kind of
you're forced to like examine the game
right
way
yeah.
sooner.
It funnels you into that because there's not much else.
Nothing for like a Timmy player to latch on to, and hardly anything for a Johnny player. It's almost entirely, you know, a Spike player's interests being piqued, just how to play the game and how to win at the game.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe a Johnny player would want to tell if they can make a spider do something useful.
maybe a Timmy would want to stack all their beetles on top of another player.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's not much else.
Yeah.
You'll just lose every game very quickly if you do something like that.
But I mean, like, at the same time, you know, like you said, having fast games is good. Lets you iterate, lets you do that. And as this game being like a fast, slight, abstract strategy game, it definitely has a place still. If that makes sense.
It has a what?
A place.
A place.
Yeah.
Like in...
in gaming as a whole, or on someone's shelf.
Like, sure.
It's good at what it does.
Right. I want to talk a little bit more about abstract games.
Oh, sure.
I have a good amount of notes. So, okay. So I want to say that I just want to sort of re-illustrate the point that I was trying to make earlier by framing it this way, in that in an abstract game, when you start the game, and this is what forces you to just think about your strategy and what turns you're going to take and how you're going to win. When you start the game, you have your components set up. In this game, they're not actually set up on a board. You just have them next to you and you just know what they do. You have your components, and then you have a goal, which is in this game to surround the enemy's piece. In other games, it's to checkmate the king. It's to capture the most territory. And then that's it. That's all you have. You have the two things, these two pieces of knowledge, and there's literally nothing else. And so the rest of the game is you just trying to figure that out. It's like, how do you reach that? The game asks you, how do you reach this winning game state? And it's up to you to figure that out right from the beginning. Other games, they might say, like, the end game state is to have the most victory points. But there won't be, like, certain specific actions that you can visualize from the beginning of the game that'll tell you, like, this is how you get the most victory points.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's like abstract strategy games have the least amount of if-thens between playing the game or between starting the game and winning. Like in, you know, even just in Catan, it's you place settlements to get resources when you roll the dice that you can then trade into settlements. And that's like, you know, the who you are and what you do, how you win has like three steps between the start of the game and the end of the game. Whereas Hive, like, it's really just one step, surround the opponent's queen. I mean, you can kind of, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's a lot more layers and, like, levels of doing things in order to do other things in other games. And that's part of what makes abstract strategy games what they are.
I think, and because of that, abstract games take very little time to explain how to play. It feels like if I were to sit down and teach someone how to play Hive, they could be playing that in seconds. Because right. You just say, like, this piece does this, this piece does this, this piece does this, this piece does this. You want to surround your opponent's queen, and then you have to play your queen within the first three turns. Go. And that's it. Yeah. And then people are just kind of left to their own devices. I think also because of this, it's very easy for someone who's never played a game of Hive before to just start a game of Hive.
Yeah.
You know, like I could say the same for chess. You know, you could sit down and say, like, here's a chessboard, here's all the pieces, here's how they move, let's play chess. And then, like, almost anybody in the world would just pick a piece and move it. And right. Then they'd pick another piece and move it, and then you'd eventually finish the game.
You know, that's why you see, like, chess boards in parks and stuff.
Right.
Because you don't see, like, quick to learn
Catan boards
yeah.
in parks. Because it's like there's way more rules to explain it seems. And yeah. You know, how you go about it. It's almost like it's a game that demands you to plan very far ahead, but it's a game that you could play, you know, functionally without planning anything in advance. Whereas in a game like Catan or in many other games, you'd have to plan very far ahead from the outset before you start playing the game.
You know, anecdotally, so we played this game last night at Friday Night Magic, and a guy sitting across from us, it seemed like he was able to pick up on all of the rules just watching us play.
Right.
And I thought that was really cool. It's like, oh yeah, this is a game that if you see it played, it's pretty intuitive. Like, you can tell, like, oh, the grasshopper's jumping over a straight line. That must be what it does.
For comparison, we play Go at the same shop in between games of Magic. And people will also, you know, stand around and watch us play. And it seems like when we play Go, less often, they understand what we're doing less often than they did with Hive, I guess.
Yeah.
But similarly, I think people do pick up what we're trying to do in Go, which is, although Go, I guess, by nature is a little harder to conceive what's happening.
Yeah.
At the beginning, because it's a very loose game that you play.
Even more abstract.
I want to talk about briefly, how do you design an abstract game?
Yeah.
And I want to say that the easiest way to go about designing an abstract game is to start with the components. Like, I could picture whoever designed Hive to have reached their conclusion by just saying, what if we design chess without a board? What shape would the pieces be? And maybe they would get to hexagons eventually. Maybe they that was their first idea. Maybe they did squares first or something.
Yeah.
But pretty much after you have the hexagons, like, the game is nearly done. You just have to decide how many different kinds of pieces do you have and how do they move.
Yeah, case in point, a whole lot of modern abstract strategy games to come out since Hive use a weird component as its component, like Castellon, which uses castle walls.
Mm-hmm. Or isn't Blockus one?
Oh yeah, Blockus, of course.
That uses, like, Tetris-shaped pieces?
Well, they're weird Tetris-shaped pieces.
Yeah, but yeah. They're more than larger than Tetris or sometimes the same size. But yeah. So if you're going to design an abstract game, I say start with the components, because that's when you're done, that's pretty much all you're left with is your components and very minimal mechanics.
Right, yeah. If you start with a mechanic, it's too easy to get into, like, a runaway mindset of just adding mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, I would say if you're designing an abstract game, don't be afraid to use things like color and more detail to indicate things, but don't make it so you need to read the information on a piece beside what the piece's name is, per se.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. Like, there's no text on things, no rules text, no explaining, no counters.
I mean, like we mentioned earlier in the episode, you want few levers.
Yeah.
You pretty much want every lever to be like, what does the piece do? Like, what's the one thing the piece does? And that's it.
Yeah.
And then you can add flavor to a game, to an abstract game. This game has flavor to it. Chess has flavor to it. But I'd say it's not, I mean, certainly not important, and it certainly shouldn't affect anything mechanically.
Right. So
to a great extent. I mean, understanding the flavor, the flavor in abstract games, the flavor doesn't actually tell you how to play the game. Right. I guess what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Like, I wrote an article on our website that was about how a specific video game uses flavor to instruct you on how to use certain weapons in the game on, like, mm-hmm. the best strategy. In an abstract strategy game, that isn't necessary at all, or shouldn't be necessary.
Right. Like, if it's just about components and mechanics, the flavor doesn't have to inform you.
It's third how to fiddle. Win.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have anything else to say.
That's about all I have to say about abstract games. So, Matthew, can you recommend any abstract games?
Not off the top of my head. Yeah. Oh, Onitama. Onitama's a neat one.
Okay.
Where players, instead of every piece moving differently, every player has a bunch of pieces that move the same way, but the methods that they move switch every turn, and they switch between players.
Is this that Kung Fu game?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, this is a very cool game. I enjoy this game.
Yeah. It also uses a rolling out mat instead of a board, which is nifty.
Mm-hmm. I would just recommend Go, because that's one of my favorite games. Although, I guess I'll say that Othello is the most like this game, but Othello is an old game.
Yeah.
You've probably already played it. And then chess. Oh, check out chess. Chess can be very interesting once you get very deep into it.
It's literally a classic.
Sure. All right. So that is our episode on Hive. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you'd like, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, to find all our episodes where we have them all tagged. So if you're trying to find an episode on a game that you're interested in, you can just go there and search for our tags, find the name of the game, and that'll take you to the episode that you're looking for. If you want, you can go to our TeePublic store. There's a link on our website. You can also go to teepublic.com/user/BGBcast. That's where we sell our merch, which is some cool t-shirts with our cool logo on it. And that does it for Board Game Bros.
And let us know if there's any other clothing styles you'd want to wear. Sure. We are interested in providing our logo on whatever people want to buy, whatever people want to wear, whatever's comfortable.
Yeah. If you will come, we will make it.
Yeah, sure. And
That does it for BG Bros plugs, so let's head over to Matt plugs.
Right. So I write articles on the BGB Cast website under the Episodes and Articles tab. I mainly write about game design, though, you know, I want to branch out in the future. My most recent article that I mentioned on this episode was over the game Enter the Gungeon and how it uses flavor and mechanics to instruct each other. And I also stream at twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream at around 11 or 12 a.m. or 11 a.m. or 12 p.m. Central U.S. time to about 2 or 3 p.m. Central U.S. time on weekdays. And I play a lot of roguelikes. I play Enter the Gungeon a lot. I play fighting games. I play other competitive games like Magic Arena every now and then. I play platformers, stuff like that. You can drop by and chat. I'm always down to chat game design or whatever. And I also have a Discord server through there that you can check out and chat to us on that server. And also on there, you'll see when I go live on Twitch.
All right. That does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.